welcome to the Game Informer Show. I'm your host, Matt Helgeson. In the studio, Andrew Reiner.
Hello.
And Dan Tack.
Hey, hey.
Hey, guys. We are here to talk about a game I've been very intrigued by since they first showed footage of it at either last E3 or their E3 before. I can't remember. But it turns out it's also one of the highest scoring games thus far of 2015. It's got our Platinum Award, 9.5 out of 10. So that's always kind of a big deal. Reiner reviewed it. The game I'm talking about is Ori and the Blind Forest, a very artful and unique 2D game. And you know, we'll get into it. We'll kind of describe it. It's maybe not been on everybody's radar, but it's certainly a game that is worth talking about and definitely lives up to its potential.
Did you say 9.5?
Right.
Oh, man, I meant it to be a 6. Just a flat 6.
So they must have just reversed that.
Come on.
Production kind of screwed that one up.
Yeah, the whole thing is you play as this white little dog thing, and I didn't think that was very cool. And I don't know. I wanted something with guns, and I don't know. Just didn't do it for me.
I think you might be underselling it a little bit there, Reiner.
Yes, I gave it a 9.5, okay? It's awesome. It's super cool to play as that dog and jump around on walls and shoot fire out of your face or wherever you projects that lightning from or whatever it is. Developed by Moon Studios, as Matt said, one of the best games of the year. It is my favorite game of the year so far. A lot of people arguing with me on Twitter about Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate. Yes, that's a great game too, but for me, I think this is it. This Ori is designed in that Metroidvania style of game. It's also beautiful. It's also of a hell of a storyteller. Everything they attempted with it is top-notch. What's your take on it so far, Tack?
You know, as a big Monster Hunter fan, I'd agree with you. Like, I haven't finished it yet, but I'm 3 or 4 hours in now after starting it last night on Steam, and I'm extremely impressed. Like, the art style is fantastic. It definitely tugs at the heartstrings.
And yeah, within the opening minutes, you get that feeling that this is a special game, right? Like, that there's something to it. There's a magic to it. There's a heart, as you're saying, that you don't usually see in games. Like, it's really emotional in the first 5 minutes. Kind of like Last of Us, right? Like that got off a start, and you're just like, whoa, okay, we're going. We're doing something crazy here. Like, this is going to be... But this one, you know, Last of Us is really like a gripping and realistic tale. This is, you know, it looks like it could be a Disney or Studio Ghibli film.
Definitely.
But at the same time, there's so much emotion, and the shots that they do are so well framed of making you fall in love with these characters right out of the gate and their world, and then chaos happens, you know, destruction. The forest they live in, their home, is falling apart. It's starting to die, and right there, you're just kind of gripped by, holy crap, what's going to happen? What's going to happen next?
Yeah, I definitely, the first time I saw it, it reminded me of Princess Mononoke a little bit, right? That's the one with those little guys.
Yes, that is the one with the little guys.
What are those called? I forgot. The little guys. It's got a real kind of, I guess, magical kind of vibe to it. Can you guys talk, without spoiling anything, about what the sort of the general setup is? I know it sounds like there's some impactful events like right off the bat, but, you know, just like, can you talk about the world, universe, or the characters?
Yeah, I'll lead up to the point of it being spoiled, right? So you follow Ori. He's the little dog critter I've been talking about. And he is he's kind of a magical being in this forest. He's tied to this giant tree, like your typical video game mana tree that you see in everything. The source of all life, right? From Avatar.
It's a very Ghibli-esque story and scenery, yeah.
But he's kind of an outcast, and he kind of finds himself on his own without family. And then this kind of sloth-like, cat-like, Pokemon-like being named Naru brings him in. And she basically makes him like her child, and they bond, and they form this friendship. They're playing together. They're like gathering fruit. Like I said, all these shots are really well done in that kind of Studio Ghibli-esque way where you're smiling the whole time. And everything's going great. And then, like I said, something bad happens. I won't go into that, but it all starts falling apart, and Ori finds himself on his own in this dying forest.
Yeah, it's all done. Those scenes in particular and at other set pieces during the game are very, very, they feel like they're right out of a film.
Yeah, and the orchestration that goes along with it too. It's also the sound in the game is top-notch too. It really pulls you in.
Yeah, and you know, it is a very beautiful game. And at the same time, I found it it's incredibly challenging, which I also really enjoy.
Yeah, it pulls no punches. It's they're fans. They said outright that they love the Metroid games and they love the Rayman games, and they wanted to make a game for that fan base and for themselves, right? So it is. There's a lot of exploration in this 2D world, just like Metroid, where you're filling in a map. But the challenges tied to that are in that hardcore, those bonus levels in Rayman sort of way, where one false move, one miscalculation in timing, and you're going to die. And it's instant death. You fall in lava, you get crushed by a rock, and then they send you back to the beginning of the challenge, and you got to go all, it's a long process to get through it, and you're going to die over and over and over again. One thing they did is allow you to save anywhere.
And I think that is actually an incredible balancing act they did. So while the game is extremely difficult, you can set up save points wherever you want. So you're like, okay, I see that there's a lot of spikes and things to jump on here. I think I'm going to set a save point here.
Yep. Or you finish something that's really hard, you save. There are sequences in the game that you cannot save in where they are like, prove your skills to us. Like, if you want to make it to the end of our game, you have to get through this really challenging sequence. You're going to die 15 times. You're going to be swearing up and down. But by the time you finish it and you create the next save point, you're like, yes, it feels so good. So it is. It looks like a game that, you know, anyone could pick up and play.
That's
and
the thing is, I really wonder about the audience that this game might attract versus this type of difficulty and whether there'll be, I don't know, problems there for some people.
I think they've done a really great job of balancing it, because it's a very learning experience.
Right.
You go to an area, you're like, wow, this seems impossible. But then you start thinking about it, looking at the environment around you, and you're like, you know what? Here's how that works. I have to jump there to trigger this other thing to happen, and then all of a sudden, I'm able to complete this challenge. And the whole, you know, it just all comes together in just an amazing little package, really.
Yeah, and I like the moves that you have. Like, you're doing double jumps, you're doing wall runs, you're gliding through, you know, spiky caverns. You have this, like, slingshot ability where enemies will shoot at you and you have to, like, grab their bullet and fling yourself into the air.
Oh, wow.
But it's all timing-based, right? Like, it's got to be perfect precision on your point of nailing it so you can get to the point you need to. And a lot of that is critical path. It's not just to find, like, that Metroid-esque, like, secret, that extra energy tank or health, you know, tank. It is just, like, critical path stuff. And that's where you, like, you do these crazy things and you're, like, holding your breath for, like, 40 seconds as you do it. And then you create that save point and you're like, oh my goodness, that was ridiculous. And it's like you said, Matt, you look at the character who just did this and you're just kind of laughing like, that's unbelievable that this little dog did all that damage and was able to fling himself all the way up here. But that's what makes it, you know, also makes it just such a unique and cool game.
It sounds like, is this a game that definitely, design-wise, from a level design, Dan, you talked about sort of learning and observing the environments. Mm-hmm. Are they pretty good about not just relying on a few tropes in terms of design, like they create a lot of different scenarios, or how is it kind of based?
They do, and like, you know, like a Metroid game, you're continually getting new abilities that let you interact with the environment in new ways. So you can go back. There's some backtracking you can do if you want to pick up, like, you know, health tanks or stuff like that. But yeah, you're continually learning, and you're continually learning how to use old abilities in new ways, and it's just it feels incredible just the way that they've set it up.
Yeah, the one gameplay component I didn't like so much was the combat. Yes, it's fun, but it's, you have no control over it really. Basically, you're just jamming on a button to shoot off fire and then it homes in on the enemy. Whereas you're going to find yourself in sequences in the game where there are a couple enemies on screen. And then you want one targeted that's nearest you, but the bolts might go to the other one. You know, that happens occasionally in the game. There's also times where it's just like the bolts are hitting a wall or something where you're like, man, I wish I had control of this to a degree. So it definitely favors the platforming and the acrobatics more than the combat, yet that component is still there. And even the boss battles are mostly about platforming rather than attacking.
In terms of, again, the story, we don't want to spoil anything, but, you know, just in terms of your satisfaction with how it all was carried out, it sounds like it gets off to a great start. It's going to hook you in. The world is really going to be evocative and artistic. You know, without saying what happens, I guess,
Yeah, and
do they come to a satisfying conclusion? Do they kind of weave all those threads into something?
Yeah, you know, the Metroid type of games in Castlevania, usually get a cutscene at the beginning and then you get a cutscene at the end. That's usually kind of how they go. This one, you're going to get a bunch of cutscenes throughout that keep evolving the story and throwing in twists and turns. There's some interesting stuff that happens in this game that I didn't see coming. It definitely compelled me. The story alone compelled me to just kind of keep going to see what was going to happen. So yes, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a very nice follow-up from what happened at the beginning and how it concludes. I don't even want to say like who the bad guy in this whole thing is. You know, there's something happening in the forest. Someone's responsible. That's interesting. And what they even go into the backstory of this entity, this thing that's in the world. Very cool stuff. Everything about this game I really liked. The only complaint I really had was, yes, it's tough. It made me swear a lot, but you know that's justified as Tack said. It's really well done. It's all on you, the player, to do it right. It's not like the game's broken or it's unfair or anything like that. And then that combat, I wish I had a little bit more control, at least the option to control it.
I think, you know, with the amount of intense platforming you have to do, it'd be really tough to try to control the combat at the same
time.
Yeah,
I agree. But there are points, like I said, like you'll see as you get a little further, but it's like, man, if I could just snipe that dude, that'd be cool. Or, you know, like just focus on the slime on the ceiling and not worry about the bouncer because I need to jump on him. Okay, I killed the bouncer. Now he's gone. Okay, now I got to go off screen, come back, have him respawn. Those kind of things where I think those could be alleviated.
About how long is the game? Is it pretty?
8 hours, 14 minutes for my save, and that was with about 60 to 70% of the secrets.
Wow.
One thing for the people out there who are playing it, don't go to the last level. You're gonna know what it is. I guess you could go in the last level. Don't go in the bottom part. You'll know when you're getting to the very end of it. Don't go there until you've collected all the stuff you want in the overworld, because once you go into this area, you finish the game, you can't go back into your game. It's done. It's like Metroid, like you're escaping and you're done, right?
Yeah. This sounds really cool. How much does it cost, by the way?
20, I believe. 20?
Wow, that's a good deal. I got to get this.
It's fantastic. And it's on Xbox One and PC.
Yeah, it's an ID at Xbox game. So it's I guess if you have a PlayStation 4 and you have a PC, don't wait for it to come to PlayStation 4, because I think this is one of those that Microsoft kind of published and helped pay for, if my memory is correct.
Right. And one thing to point out, Moon Studio, it's a group of like famed developers all working around the world together on this game. They didn't have like a set studio for a certain amount of time, or if ever, I'm not sure of that. But, you know, one of the art leads from Blizzard was on it, and it's absolutely stunning. I cannot point out how beautiful it is enough. Like everything's always moving in the game, the trees, stuff in the foreground, it's you know, like creatures dashing around. It's really cool looking. Your eye is always darting around looking at the little details in the world.
Yeah, it's always cool when you see, because indie developers, you know, that have just sort of come up in that scene, I think bring a lot of new ideas and a lot of cool stuff to the table. It's also cool to see, you know, when guys that have kind of come up in the AAA space go indie, you can definitely sometimes see that just a certain craftsmanship and just a lot of experience over the years with, like, you know, making games and shipping games and just some of that know-how, I think, can be a valuable thing even when it's being used
and it's
in a different space.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things, like, just talking to developers at, like, E3 and trade shows and stuff like that, or even, you know, just interviews, it's like one thing a lot of people talk about when we're talking about games that need to come back, it's like Metroid. It's like, why hasn't Nintendo made a new like 2D Metroid? That'd be so awesome. It's great to see these teams, these smaller teams, being able to do that and knock it out of the park without having that license, right? Like, if you like Metroid or the Castlevania games, you absolutely have to check this game out because it's definitely one of the best in that kind of field.
Very cool. Dan, you sound probably, I know you haven't finished it, but you sound nearly as enthusiastic as Ryan are about this, right?
I am. I'm definitely along the lines of thinking right now that this is definitely the best game I've played so far this year.
Nice.
It's really a great play on PC with your Xbox wired controller naturally. I don't think there's keyboard controls to cut it, but.
And it gets better as it goes. Like that, there's like a last area where it all comes together and you're just like, the challenge is just ridiculous, but it's like, that's awesome.
Very cool. Awesome. This is it's always exciting to get, you know, a game. It's not like, it's not mixed. It's like, this is a 9.5. This is going to be one of the best games of the year. We'll be talking about this at the end of the year as far as those conversations go. So that's a cool thing. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you stopping
Absolutely.
By. Stick around. We'll be back with more Game Informer Show. Sure. Welcome back to the Game Informer Show. In the second segment, we are going to get into some more notable games that were released this week. To that end, I have Kim Wallace in the studio.
Hello.
And Brian Shea.
Hey, hey.
Hey, guys. We're going to talk about three games. I think all interesting games in their own right and definitely worth talking about. We'll kick things off with a sequel to sort of an indie darling of a couple years ago, probably by now. Mm-hmm. Hotline Miami 2, Wrong Number, a sort of, I don't know what, macabre, murder-centric.
Very, very violent.
Violent, dark, top-down indie game. So I guess, for, you know, maybe if people aren't familiar with Hotline Miami in general, just kind of give us the rundown, Brian.
Yeah, sure. So the first game, you kind of followed these serial killers as they went around and committed heinous acts across different buildings in the city of Miami. Imagine that. In the late 80s and early 90s, I believe it takes place. And because of that, like, you know, there's a lot of like VHS stuff that you see, like a lot of references to early 90s technology, which is kind of cool having, you know, grown up in that time. But it's very, very graphic, very violent, but it also has that retro, like Super NES graphic style that they have. And they fully embrace that with like nods to NES or Super NES games. And like there's a, in Hotline Miami 2, there's even a store where you go into a department store and clear out a room of enemies. And one of the enemies is like just completely obsessed with like the it's called Super Fun, but it's in the font of the Super NES logo and everything. So they fully embrace that. And it's really cool. But, the soundtrack is also another thing that people love about these games. I forget what the genre is called. Tim Turry gave me a rundown on it. But it's like kind of like a lo-fi...
Outrun? Was that what it's called?
I'm not sure. But it's like a lo-fi electronica with like heavy bass. And it's really cool. Like it's been a while since I found a soundtrack that I really, really love. But
it reminds me a little bit of like Giorgio Moroder, the like 80s dude that did movies like Scarface and stuff like that.
Sure.
I think it had that kind of, that's probably where the Miami vibe comes in.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that the first soundtrack, at least I haven't heard the second one, but the first soundtrack's excellent.
Oh, and there were some levels where I would get into it and I'd be so frustrated because that's another trademark of Hotline Miami is it's extremely difficult. Very trial and error based. Like you die and you press A and you're instantly back to the start of that section. But the whole time the music just keeps playing and I was hearing songs for like, you know, 30 minutes at a time, but I never got sick of some of them. Like some of them I'd be like, all right, that's enough of this song. And I'd take my headphones off. But other ones, like I would say the vast majority of them, I would just be just kind of grooving as I'm completely controller throwingly frustrated.
I think that's cool because so many times in games we don't notice the soundtrack as much or it's just kind of there in the background, and the fact that like you're getting frustrated and you're still like digging on the music as you go is pretty cool.
Yeah, there were some levels where I was really into the music and it was awesome.
So are you playing in two as a serial killer or somebody that's like tracking serial killers?
The first game, I believe you were, I didn't finish the first game all the way through. And it's also been, you know, several years since I've played it, but, I believe the first one you were just serial killers. And then this one, it changes perspective a whole bunch. You are serial killers. You're a detective who's tracking serial killers. You're a writer who's writing about the serial killers in the first game.
Ooh, I like this.
So it's a pretty cool story, and the narrative comes together pretty nicely. It tries to do a little bit too much at first, but it comes together really, really well at the end.
Manhunt was a game that brought up some of that stuff. How is it, you know, like playing as a serial killer? Do you have any, like, I don't know, reservations about how it handles that kind of stuff? Or, like, is it pretty unapologetically just, like, a slasher kind of thing?
I think at first you're kind of like shocked that you're just going into these rooms and just wiping out men. But I mean, that's also something that you do a lot of in games in general nowadays. But
that's true.
But yeah, it's they kind of touch on that a little bit in the story, where like there's reasons why you're doing these things.
Doesn't it try to make you feel a little guilty about it though as you go on? I remember the first game from what I played. You knew you were doing something really bad, which mm-hmm. you couldn't stop in a sense. And then at the same time, you had this like, oh my gosh, this is crazy guilt going on.
Yeah, it kind of toys with that whole player agency thing where you have to do this. Like you can't progress through the game unless you go through and kill everybody in this thing. But it's like you have no choice. So it's kind of a cool look at that. But it's kind of an interesting thing to see all these opinion pieces popping up across the web right now about whether Hotline Miami 2 celebrates it or celebrates the violence that it's showcasing, or if it's more of like a look at, you know, this violence and is it necessarily a good thing that it's happening. So there's kind of differing views on how the game portrays the violence that it's seemingly celebrating on the surface, but it might be taking a different look at it if you kind of think about it a little bit more.
Right. So you mentioned trial and error. Is there a sort of a puzzle element to how you like just approach killing all these people, or is it pretty much like a Smash TV, like old school, just run around, shoot, and twitch reflex kind of thing?
You know, it's kind of a combination of both. Like you can run into a room and start shooting and you're going to kill a few people, but you're not going to make it through any levels just, you know, flying by the seat of your pants. You're going to have to kind of approach a room and like think, okay, well, there's two guys with guns. There's a guy with a baseball bat. How am I going to burst into this room and take them out? So you kind of think in your head, all right, well, if I kick in the door while the guy with the gun is behind the door, it'll knock him over. I can shoot the first guy with the gun, and then I can shoot the guy with the baseball bat. And then by the time the guy gets up that I knocked over with the door, you're going to be able to have the other two guys dead, and then you can take him out without his gun. So it's kind of like you have to think like logically through, like, all right, well, I got to, you know, knock that guy out while I take the other two out, and then by the time they're dead, I'll be able to take care of him too. So you're outgunned in every single level, and you have to be very strategic in how you approach it. And in that sense, it's very puzzle-esque, because you have to figure out the room, or else, you know, you're not going to last long. And some of the rooms have windows, so it's like you have to kind of be very cognizant of your surroundings.
Overall, I mean, it sounds like you like a lot of stuff about it. At the same time, I remember sauntering by your desk and finding you in various states of rage.
Yes.
Some emotional, bad emotions going on, Brian. So like how in the ultimate assessment, I guess, what'd you give the game? How did you balance out? You know, you certainly seemed a little angry at times.
Yeah. I mean, but that's what the game is all about, is it's frustrating, but it's also extremely, extremely rewarding. So as angry as I got every single time, like you'd have this tense frustration built up the entire time you're playing a level. And it's like, oh, this is the 30th time I've gone through this level. But then the moment you kill the last guy, there's like a moment where it pauses, and then right across the screen, it just screeches level clear. And it's like all that tension and all that frustration just goes away all at once. And you're just left with this sense of reward and relief. And it's very unparalleled in that sense. So I think that kind of boosted the game up in my perspective. And I gave it an 8.5 out of 10.
Cool. So definitely worth checking out, as long as you know what you're kind of getting into going in.
Yeah, definitely don't go in thinking, oh, I'm going to be playing Smash TV where I can just run into a room and hold the left or the right stick in one direction and kill everyone with ease. You're going to be dying a lot.
Cool. Well, and then the soundtrack, I'm sure, is probably available as well, and that's definitely worth checking
and
out.
I think if you buy the vinyl, you get the a Steam code for the game as well.
Oh, really?
So that's kind of a cool bonus.
I might do that. Maybe I'll buy it that way. That's a good idea. Kim, let's move on to the next game. And this has been, I think, a pretty highly anticipated game in some respects, just because it's a Nintendo game. They rarely come out with, I guess, you know, a brand new IP, brand new characters. And it's not, you know, based on a, you know, Mario or anything else, you know, spinoffs and anything like that. It's Project Steam.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
Codename Steam.
I'm sorry, Codename Steam. Codename Steam, which I believe Steam is Strike Team Eliminating the Alien Menace. That was in the last segment. Reiner asked me what it meant. Is that what it is?
I didn't even ever consider looking at it, because the whole game functions on Steam, and I just thought that was like a clever play. But
I'm going to go with that. People in the comments can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if I just pulled that out of my butt or that's really true.
If you did, that would be really amazing if it worked out. But hey, so this game is actually by Intelligent Systems, and they're known for the Fire Emblem series, which I adore, and also Advanced Wars. So this was them doing something a little different, and I like that they got a little zany with it. You're like fighting, you join up with Abraham Lincoln and you're fighting extraterrestrials that are coming in, is the basis of it. And you kind of recruit characters from like the Wizard of Oz and like Tom Sawyer and all that as you go on. So little crazy premise, something different. You're in like this kind of comic book art style going on with it, but For as crazy as that premise is, like, don't expect the story to do anything for you or be grand. I mean, this is all about the strategy gameplay, which I adored and I thought was fantastic. Like, it is intelligent systems in that respect. The problems that people are having with it, because I knew this was a little bit of a divisive game for some people. I gave it an 8 because I enjoyed it, but it is a slower paced strategy game. And for some people, that's going to be something that is going to be hard because of the fact that every time you complete a turn, you have to watch the enemies do their turns. And it's about like a minute, minute and a half that you have to wait every time there's a turn. And I know a lot of people having problems with it. I noted it in my review. Like, I wish they gave an option to speed it up. I wish you could skip it if you wanted to. But besides that, that's like the only knock I really have against the game. The strategy gameplay is fantastic. Basically, you have so much steam that controls like everything from movement to launching attacks, and every character you get has different abilities. So as you go on, you'll get somebody who can like has a grenade launcher, somebody who can snipe, somebody who can just like has a penguin that you can launch and just blows up in front of people. Like, there's a lot of cool things as you go on, but it's trying to find the elements of like what party members are right for you and get through every stage. And there's a great deal of mission variety too. Like, sometimes you'll have to escort someone and make sure they're safe. Sometimes you'll be like a huge like boss will be coming in and you have to stop them before they storm your base. There's so much going on that's good with the game that it really sucks that the turn thing kind of went unnoticed by the developers, that might be an issue for people. So.
Yeah, that is, it's such a basic thing. Mm-hmm. And I just,
well, even like their past games like Fire Emblem and stuff, like you've always been able to speed that stuff up where it hasn't been, or the turns play out very quickly. The problem with these is that they just don't play out quickly. So it's kind of like, oh, you're in the action. Now I have to stop for a bit and wait for this to happen. And it's not like what you're looking at is very exciting either, because half the times like the camera angles get cut off on the environments a little bit. But other than that, like, that's the only like bad thing I can say. Like, I loved, just this game's challenging too, and I think like for some people it's going to be a challenge that they're really going to revel in, maybe others not so much. I thought it was great. Like, I was addicted to this game. Like, every night I was playing it before bed just to like pass a stage and just figure out a way around it, because the game is very unapologetic. After like a few turns, you'll get like waves of enemies that just like rush in for reinforcements. So you're like, oh, damn it. And then, or a new enemy just appears. There's like these guys called Ice Stalkers who can just randomly pop up, and you can't injure them at all. So you can't kill them and you can't be in their vicinity. So you have to move a certain amount of spaces with your steam. Otherwise, they just flutter attacks on you. And it's just like this unexpected like element that really kind of gets you in the game that I thought was done really well.
Do you get the sense that this could be a franchise in the long term? I mean, do you think that this basic format is something that was cool for one game? Could it have legs? Could it be expanded in certain ways? Obviously, you have the annoyance factor, mm-hmm, of the not being able to speed things along, oh, which, yeah, is obviously fixable. But how taken were you in terms of this being like a new Nintendo franchise, or do you think this will be sort of a cool thing they did once?
I think this will be a one and done, to be honest with you. I like the concepts of everything and I had a blast with it, but I don't think it's necessarily a formula that needs to repeat itself. I would prefer intelligent systems, honestly, to focus on Fire Emblem. And now that we haven't heard anything about Fire Emblem Shin Megami Tensei yet, I kind of being a little selfish there, but you know what? It's good for what it is. It's not like, I keep telling people, don't expect it to top games like Fire Emblem, this Fire Emblem series, or Advanced Wars, but it is a solid strategy RPG and I had a blast with it. So
it's interesting art style too.
Yeah, strategy game rather. It's not really an RPG. I'm just like, yeah, the art style is cool. It's
cell shading back.
The 3D, actually, I never use 3D on my 3DS just because it drives me nuts. But mm-hmm, I actually thought the 3D looked really good in this game, so I'd turn it on every so often. Just like the whole comic book aesthetic, it kind of makes it pop really nice.
Mm-hmm.
And Will Wheaton. How was Will Wheaton?
Will's always great. Come on.
Yeah.
I had issues with some of the voice acting, not particularly his, but some was a little like overdone, especially like the Tom Sawyer's characters, like trying to get that twang down. Like it was a little kind of offensive at some points, but you know, it was supposed to be goofy, and it is. It's just a fun romp. You know, it's a fun strategy game. It's something different. It's unlike what they've done before. I like the whole like steam powers everything, and if you leave a little bit of steam in the tank when you end your turn, if another enemy like comes in your line of sight, then you'll automatically target it and get a great counterattack. There's just like so many different strategies that come into play. Even like, I mean, I was on like even chapter 14, I was getting surprised by stuff. So I mean, and that was like 18 hours in, I think I was at that point. So I say a good strategy game always like keeps you on your toes, makes you constantly like think a way around. And two, I did try the amiibo support, which is freaking awesome, by the way. If you can put Ike in your game from Fire Emblem, he's got some really cool attacks. I mean, I don't know. Cool. I love my strategy games, and yeah. I'm really particular about them. And I had so like I know when I can't put a game down that it's done something right. So despite those slow turns, I found it was more rewarding to get through those levels and be able to say I beat those baddies up like a boss. Like a boss.
Like a boss. Cool. You gave it a
8
out of 10. So another solid score. Real quick before we wrap up too, I wanted to touch on a game that probably doesn't have nearly the name recognition or maybe advanced hype of these other two games, but I think is worth talking about. Brian reviewed it, and it's probably been a little bit off people's radar. It's called City Skyline.
Yes. It's pretty much a, if SimCity was done right the last time they tried. It's everything Zing. That... it's everything City Builder fans want.
Let's not speak ill of the dead, okay?
I think
everyone paid for that dearly.
I love Maxis. I really do.
I do too.
It's just the last SimCity left me so cold, and I still try to play it every so often, but I don't think I'm going to keep playing after City Skylines came out just because it's that good. It's just a very solid, modern city builder, and it gives you everything that you kind of want in a city builder. Like it gets out of your way. It lets you kind of create the city of your dreams as long as you're good enough to do it. It's a pretty unforgiving simulator also, so it has a little bit of element of that trial and error that Hotline Miami brought in. Maybe not in the same way, but there are similarities that you can draw there. It took me about maybe a dozen tries to get a viable city going in my game, but once I did, it was a blast, and I had a pretty bustling metropolis going.
What do you all manage for the? Is it the same as like SimCity?
I mean, you start off building the roads and putting in like the power grid and the plumbing and like a water pump to get your sewage out into the water, and you know it's the basic stuff at first, and then you start zoning and. All right, this is going to be residential, this is going to be industrial, this is going to be commercial, and then you start leveling up from there. Once you level up, like I think it's like when you get 400 citizens in your mm-hmm. city, you can unlock other types of zones and other types of, like you can tax people. Like you can say, all right, well, residential people are going to start paying 12% instead of 9%, mm-hmm. and you kind of manage your budget where you can put more funding towards like fire departments, and that makes it so that there's more firefighters, there's more fire trucks. They get to the houses with better efficiency. Same thing with like, you know, hospitals, police officers, or
These
police
are important
stations.
Things.
Yeah. So, I mean, you got to keep your crime rate down. You got to make sure houses aren't burning down left and right. You can put in different policies. Like you can say, all right, well, everybody's going to get a smoke detector if they move into my city. It costs a little bit. I think it costs like $5 or 5 cents per.
But it saves a life.
Yeah. But it greatly reduces the risk of fires and like houses burning down. And also, like you know, there's different policies. You can legalize recreational drugs, and that increases that increases your tax. It increases your or decreases your crime rate, and increases happiness, but also
increases
like,
happiness.
Yes, it definitely increases the happiness in the game. And but yeah, and the cool thing about this is that unlike SimCity, you can kind of expand out. Like so, you start off with a tiny square like plot of land, and then as you get more money, you'll get and more citizens, you'll get little messages that say. A new plot of land is available, and you can purchase it. And it's relatively cheap to purchase the land, but then obviously to develop it, it's really expensive to do that. You have to pave the roads. You got to make sure the power grid reaches over to them, make sure you have enough power plants to power a larger plot of land. So it's like I started off and like you get like, you know, it's pretty easy to your first 500 citizens. But after that, it becomes more and more unmanageable as you're kind of having to oversee a larger group of people. And I think I had my best city up to about 22,000 people. And then I accidentally placed a dam in the river. I didn't accidentally, but I didn't realize the implications of placing a dam in the key river of my property. Uh-oh. And it just drained the river and plummeted all of my citizens to severe illness. And it destroyed the economy. And my city was down to, I think, about 7,000 people in a matter of like 15 minutes.
You blew it.
It was bad.
Well, you know, it's almost kind of... I mean, it sounds cool. It sounds like it's definitely going to fill a place in the market that now, sadly, is maybe a little bit up in the air.
Well, now Paradox just announced. So Paradox Interactive is the publisher. They just announced today that it's their fastest selling game of all time.
Wow.
250,000 already.
And it came out on Tuesday. That's great.
I have a feeling, listening to it now on this podcast, I'm going to go buy it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's $30, or you can buy the deluxe edition for $40 on Steam.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... it reminds me a little bit of, like, I think, you know, when a game kind of hits that window, like Torchlight maybe did before, like Diablo came out and stuff like that. It's good that somebody's done the city builder right. It seems pretty unapologetic that it's just like, we wanted to make a good SimCity game, and sounds like they did.
Yeah.
Too bad. Again, too bad Maxis couldn't have. So But at least the gameplay ideas live on, I guess. So thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate you talking about all three of these games. They sound well worth checking out. And also, obviously, Ori and the Blind Forest, which we talked about earlier. It's a very good week in games this week. And stick around. We're going to be talking about Star Wars, the upcoming movies. There's been some news today, and just, you know, a little geeking out about Star Wars never hurt. So stick around for that. Welcome back to the Game Informer Show. I'm still Matt Helgeson, but now Matt Miller's here.
Hey, hey.
As is Andrew Reiner.
Matt Reiner. That's my new name.
Andrew.
We need more Matt in this office.
Andrew Matt Reiner. Sounds like, that's a good name. I like that.
I like it.
Sounds like a rogue cop.
Speaking of rogues
and squadrons, we're just going to talk a little bit about some Star Wars news that came out today. There's been, these have been sort of known that there were, in addition to the new trilogy, there was going to be some standalone movies in the Star Wars universe. We found out a little bit more about those today. Reiner, obviously you keep pretty up to date on your Star Wars news. So tell us what the stuff today was about.
So we know The Force Awakens comes out December 18th this year. Next year, we're getting a new Star Wars film called Star Wars Rogue One. That is next December as well, like December 16th, I believe. And then the following May, we're getting, following May, 6 months later, we're getting Star Wars Episode 8. I guess the surprise there was it's called Rogue One. You know, we all knew.
Not Episode 8.
Yeah, we knew Episode 8 and 9 were coming, right? But Rogue One, which implies that it might be about Rogue Squadron to a certain degree, at least a rogue pilot who we may or may not have seen in the trailer. We'll see.
I'm gonna go out on a limb here and say it's both of those things. I bet it's about it Rogue Squadron, and it turns out there's a rogue pilot in Rogue Squadron.
Oh,
whoa,
okay.
You heard it here first.
And one thing I thought that was encouraging, though, Reiner, was some of the names attached, at least on the directing and writing front.
I guess it's a little weird. The Rogue One is Gareth Edwards. We knew that already. Gary Whitta, who wrote...
he wrote the initial treatment, right?
The initial treatment, and then Chris Weitz, he ended up doing the follow-up treatment on that. They're doing the Rogue One movie, but then, Episode 8 has... it's weird. It's Rian Johnson who's doing it. It's not J.J. Abrams. I thought J.J. would be on all three of them.
Yeah.
But it's Rian Johnson. It sounds like he might be attached to 9 as well. That's the rumor. But he did Looper.
He's writing a treatment, right?
He wrote it and he's directing. Yeah. So he did Looper. If you've seen that movie, it's fantastic. I don't know how he is at his chops are at writing space opera sci-fi, but we'll see.
Well, there's a lot of reasons I'm excited about that. I mean, Looper is, I think, one of the best sci-fi movies to come out in the last few years. And so it's a cool choice to be able to bring in one of these people who is pushing the boundaries of interesting science fiction. I also like that
Looper established him as someone who could do good science fiction and integrate sort of some dark themes and difficult situations. And if episode 8 follows suit with what we would expect, that should be a pretty dark episode in the new trilogy, right? Like, it's sort of the midpoint of the story. It's our Empire Strikes Back.
Right.
Yeah, which also, that was, Lucas didn't direct Empire, did he?
Right.
That was, who was that?
Kasdan.
Lawrence Kasdan.
Yeah. Yep.
And he wrote, he wrote episode 7 with JJ, right? Is that, that's, am I...
I don't remember
it's
how
the writer. It's the writer of Empire worked with JJ.
Yeah,
I don't remember if it's the same name.
And I can't remember exactly what his involvement was. He either helped co-write or advised or something like that. I think you might be right, though. I think it was, he was credited as a co-writer.
Another thing I think that we could probably all agree on is that maybe Harrison Ford, who's apparently crashed multiple planes... and crashed another one last week and has already broke his leg in the filming of the new trilogy, could just maybe chill out, you know,
yeah,
maybe some new hobbies, take up chess, go to the gym. I don't know. Maybe get some safer hobbies there, Harrison, because he literally crashed a plane like last week and he'd already broken a leg. And apparently in the article, it said this was like not a rare occurrence that he crashes planes, apparently. So
I know, yeah, and he crashed a helicopter, and yeah, he needs to stay out of the sky. I mean, unless he's in the fake Falcon.
He's in good shape for his age, for sure, but he's, you know, not as young as he used to be, maybe, you know.
Do you think when he's all alone up in the sky, he pretends to be Han Solo sometimes?
I think he wants to be Luke Skywalker. That's why he picks those like the single
know.
Engine like the planes that are kind of like X-Wings.
Do you think he pretends to talk to Chewbacca while he's up there? And maybe that's why he crashed, as he was shouting at Chewbacca.
I don't know if Harrison seems like kind of he's on his own weird like trip, though. You know, like, talk about guys whose movie personas, and like then when you see him on like David Letterman or something, it's like, he's just a weird dude. You
yeah.
know? Like, he's odd.
I mean, I think the old story was that like he wasn't even really ever... all that into acting, right? Didn't he start out as like a carpenter or
yes.
something like that?
Yeah.
And he kind of just, it felt like he sort of fell into the life of being this big name Hollywood yeah. actor that everybody loves.
He never seems particularly like into it when
no.
you see him in interviews.
No, exactly. I mean, I think he thinks the whole thing is pretty silly. And the
yeah.
fact that the franchises that he has been most connected to, being Indiana Jones and Star Wars, are these sort of silly, pulpy action adventures. I think it is sort of like funny to him.
Well, hold on a sec though, because I've read these reports. These are real things that he owns a helicopter, and like they call him when people are like missing on mountains, and he goes and rescues them. He's done this twice.
I totally believe that. Yeah.
No,
totally
he's done this twice. Like he found a woman that was missing for days, and then like a kid that was missing, and he like flew his helicopter over there, found them, and then brought them back.
That's awesome.
So he is like a real hero.
Can you imagine, by the way, put yourself in the situation, you're a 10-year-old kid lost on a mountain with your mom, and all of a sudden Indiana Jones comes down in a helicopter and picks you up.
It'd be the best thing ever.
It would really be the best thing ever.
You would just keep getting lost in the woods.
Yeah, just Reiner, you're just going to try to concoct this, aren't you? Now you're going to find out where he lives.
And
help
find a nearby
help
mountain.
Me.
I need Han Solo.
So we have two new Star Wars films coming after episode 7. It's almost like a dream. Like, this is something like we would have talked about years ago and it never happened, right? Like, we're getting a new Star Wars film every year. We're getting Marvel Comics movies every year. We're getting DC Comics movies every year. We're getting Avatar movies every year moving forward. We're getting new Harry Potter movies moving forward every year. This is going to be crazy. These next, like, Lego movies every year. It's these next, like, 4 years is just going to be awesome, nerdy, licensed stuff in theaters.
It's going to be a lot of movies, that's for sure.
And when is that bubble going to burst? I don't know if it ever will. I mean, this is what people, by and large, are going to the cinema for, right?
I mean,
the ones every year that make the most money next to American Sniper, right?
I think there's a recognition from a number of different circles right now that Marvel's cinematic universe is a recipe for success. Whether you're talking about comic book movies or elsewhere,
yeah,
the public... I think has over time come to what like the nerd community got to some decades ago, which is that serialized storytelling is really enjoyable to get excited about and to get involved in.
Yeah.
And I think the wider public has gotten indoctrinated to that stuff with some of the TV of the last decade, things like Lost and Battlestar Galactica and stuff like that.
But you're never going to have the budget of these big ones, right?
And so you now have really a lot of different folks, and certainly Disney, who are interested in, you know, creating this sort of shared universe that everything ties together. And it's not like it's a brand new idea, right? I mean, like, Star Wars helped to pioneer that idea back in the 70s and the 80s. But with Disney at the helm, it's going to be much more focused effort, I think, to do that.
Yeah. I mean, Star Wars basically was kind of the prototype of the entire blockbuster franchise in films.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right that comics have kind of had that for a while. But, you know, I mean, Star Wars kind of invented this whole industry that Marvel operates in.
Yep.
And the other thing, the reason that Hollywood loves these films, too, is they travel well.
Right.
They travel to Asian markets well. They travel to the Middle East well. They travel to Latin America well. Because, you know, there's certain things where it's like, I'm trying to think of a movie that did pretty well. You guys seen Silver Linings Playbook?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great movie, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But does somebody that lives in Shanghai and works in the fish market relate to, you know, Bradley Cooper and his dad bonding over the Philadelphia Eagles?
But Matt, boy, do I have a movie for you. Transformers, set partially in Hong Kong.
There you go.
I'm making your point for you, right?
No, yeah. But it is just like dramas can do well, I think, and get to that, like, wow, that movie made like $175 million in the U.S. and they probably do okay in like England, maybe. But there's just culturally, there's more cultural things, and I'm sure that there's movies being made in you know, Japan and China and, you know, Israel right now that are very, you know, germane to their cultures that we don't really see or get, you know. So the superhero kind of larger than life sci-fi stuff and fantasy, you know, kind of does, it travels pretty well, you know.
I just wonder about the regular movies outside of these now. Like, I mean, there's more and more taking up more weeks, you know, in the box office. They're gonna kind of, to a degree, they have to start playing second fiddle, you know, like these big Oscar nominated films that release in their own week and it has the big star power.
Well,
you can't go against, like,
I think
Avatar, Captain America. Yeah. And,
but it is slightly different audiences, right?
It is, but I mean, these weeks keep filling up. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to get DC added in there. You're going to get those Harry Potter films, those Lego films. I mean, there's 52 weeks in a year, and they're quickly being consumed, gobbled by all these movies.
I think that, you know, Netflix, I think, is going to, I read that they're going to start, you know, fun. They've been doing series like House of Cards, obviously, but I think they're going to start doing features too, that are funded by Netflix and exclusive to Netflix.
I can believe that.
And yeah, a good movie's always going to do well, right? Like, mm-hmm. you think it's going to get the audience, but there's a reason why Hollywood staggers the films each week. Like, they don't want to be in the same week as other ones, just because that first week is so important for box office.
Definitely.
But it's going to be interesting. It's going to be fun for us, though. Like, for the people that are vested in these things, it just keeps blowing up and getting bigger and bigger, and there's no end in sight at this point. Like, they just keep adding on movies.
Yeah. One of the things... I'm really stoked about bringing it back to Rogue One, is that the one big announcement that they made alongside with that is that their starring character is a young woman.
Felicity Jones.
Who I think a lot of people might know from Theory of Everything, was one of her big parts.
Yeah, she was great in that.
But that's, I mean, in the grand perspective of big sci-fi action movie stuff, I don't think... we should forget about the significance of having that be the way that you roll out info on your movie, right? Like, the idea that you're going to have the main character here be a female, I think, is a big deal in the Star Wars fiction and in the broader scope of, like, big blockbuster movies. And I think I'll be interested to see what role that character is. Presumably, like, if the movie is what we think it is, and it's sort of like a dogfighting movie about...
I bet it's Top Gun.
Yeah.
Star Wars Top Gun.
You know, just to get nerdy for a second, I kind of think what it could be is... Wedge Antilles is Rogue One, right? During the normal time period, right? So I would imagine that this is the movie about the next person in line, right?
Wedge Jr.
Wedge Jr. Or maybe Wedge's daughter.
Yeah,
right?
You're probably right. It's probably Wedge's daughter.
Kind of coming into her own to run Rogue Squadron. I mean, that's a movie I'd be excited to check out.
You know, before the show, Miller, as you pointed out, you know, for tying this back to games and possible licensed products or anything, like, you know, there's been a pretty strong space combat, you know, franchise with the word Rogue in it.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So Might not be a bad time to bring that one back either, you know? And I think people would, a next gen high end PC version of that would be pretty cool.
I mean, I'm going to be really interested to see what Disney does with the Star Wars video game license moving forward. I mean, right now EA owns, or I don't know if they own or they're longtime licensee.
They can license the classic trilogy, and I think they have a deal worked out for the new trilogy as well, right?
Regardless, the fact remains that right now we've got not a lot of big Star Wars game stuff planned, and it feels weird where during this period where there's such fervor around the franchise and the return of these new movies that we haven't heard about more stuff. Now, I'm kind of crossing my fingers that that's going to happen at
E3. I hope it does, but at the same time, I wouldn't put it past Disney to not do anything console. They haven't done it with Marvel.
Exactly. And which worries me a little bit.
There's no
right?
Avengers game. That blows my mind.
Yep.
Like, I wake up in the middle of the night like, how is this happening?
Yeah, it does seem weird. I mean, and certainly they've got a business strategy that, you know, these mobile games, some of which have actually been pretty decent, but these smaller mobile games for Marvel properties have done pretty well for them. But it does seem like they're missing out on a really enthusiastic audience of core gamers that want like console and PC games and want more of them than just, you know, having Battlefront on the horizon or this distant in the future right. Visceral game.
And I will point out that they were working on a Avengers game.
Yeah.
Footage leaked online. It was first person, which is very strange.
Yeah.
But it looked kind of cool, but that got canceled. So they just, you know, we don't know what happened. This could be like in a Half-Life type of thing where they've had false starts all the way through or they just shelved it. We don't know. Right.
Right.
Well, but yeah, we'll have to see what they do with Star Wars. But, I'm
I mean,
curious.
Amy Hennig's working on it, right?
She's
working
on
the
on
Visceral one.
Yeah, the Visceral one.
And then have they announced a date for Battlefield?
For Battlefront?
Front, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Front.
I don't think so.
This fall?
I mean, if they don't get it out, how could you not do Battlefront this fall?
I thought it was supposed to be this year.
I mean, thought that's what
it was announced
said,
2 years ago.
Year, and that's I mean, all they
it was
said,
announced maybe 2 years ago, for sure.
Yeah, and then Battlefield Hardline slipped into this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, there are two different dev teams at DICE.
But to not take advantage of what's going to be like the biggest media blitz for quite some years, I would say.
Yeah.
Seems insane to not get Battlefront out this year.
Well, and if you look a year past that, if you don't have a game called Rogue something, Rogue Squadron, Rogue Leader, Rogue won the game, something like that, that taps in to the fact that you have this giant Star Wars movie coming out at Christmas time and you don't in the holiday season release a video game that's connected to it, that would be crazy.
I don't know why they would have to do it,
especially if you think about it. You've got this broader movement right now with things like Star Citizen just gobbling up money from people who are like fans who are enthusiastic to see some outer space shooting stuff. There is a market for that. There are people who want that kind of a game, who miss X-Wing and they miss TIE Fighter and they miss Rogue Squadron. I don't know. It seems like a no-brainer to me that you do a game like that.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not saying they're easy to make a good flight sim game, but at the same time, it's a very fixed point. You know the kind of elements you're dealing with, and you know, I think it's a very doable thing, and they've certainly done great work before. It does look like Battlefront is supposed to be holiday 2015.
Okay.
At this point, I'd be shocked if they don't make that. I mean, it's just
to match up with the movie release.
Oh, they have to. Yeah.
That's huge.
That'd be a disaster if they didn't.
So yeah, it's exciting stuff. The other thing that I was happy to find out about, I was looking at the Star Wars Force Awakens Wikipedia. I did not know Max von Sydow was still alive.
Well, there you go.
He's still alive and well. He's going to be in the movies.
Yeah.
At age 85. So
he's going to do it.
Good for him.
Most of them are back. Yeah. You got the core group. Kenny Baker's back too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Warwick Davis is going to be somebody.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. And that weird, the ball, like R2-D2 thing with a round ball as its bottom.
Yeah.
From the trailer that everyone BB-8. Everyone freaked out about him. He's going to be a star. He's got star power.
You know, right? Matt, that's not CG.
That's a real thing.
That's a real thing.
That is, I mean, that's kind of the deal, though, isn't? Aren't they kind of trying to rely as much as they can on physical stuff and models?
Yeah. But, you know, I watched that trailer the first time and I was like, that's totally CG. And then you find out it's not. And it's like, wow, that's impressive tech.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that because I do think that there is something to good physical models and some of that old technique stuff, and they can enhance it obviously with CG, but I'm glad JJ seems to be trying to be true to it rather than just be like, you know, a Spider-Man movie with, you know, Han Solo in it or whatever.
To wrap it back to Harrison Ford, you see Carrie Fisher said that she thinks the movie's cursed. She got in a car accident the same week Harrison, or the week after, or before Harrison's plane went down. So she called Mark Hamill concerned. She's like, these things always happen in threes.
Well, alternately, maybe Mark Hamill is sabotaging his co-stars.
About that? Oh, yeah, could be.
Carrie Fisher's also a very interesting individual. Yes. Just in general. She's still remember she had the best line in the history of 30 Rock, which is like never, or you remember she was like, she wasn't her line, but it was Alec Baldwin. She was like a hippie that Tina Fey got in with. And Baldwin was like, never follow a hippie to a second location. I was like, love that line. Anyway, Carrie Fisher's weird.
But yeah, so hopefully, knock on wood, the movie turns out good, and we're really excited for the future plans they have. Obviously, there's a lot riding. We're already seeing a lot riding on this first release.
And we're going to have a full trailer here, which presumably...
Star Wars Celebration in April.
Yeah, like presumably we're going to get to see finally the old characters all dressed up in their new duds.
I have read reports of a screening of said trailer.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds very cool.
Yeah.
If these reports are true. But they came in from multiple sources at the same time, so people think it is.
Yeah. Well, there's cool stuff coming. I also, just another lesser talked about piece of Star Wars news that came through in the last couple days. They have somewhere in the vicinity of 20 books planned between now and like
the release of the movie. But that includes like sticker books and kids books. But those kids books are good. Like, I've read the Star Wars Rebels kids books. They're good.
All I'm saying is that's a lot of books.
That's a lot of fiction. And it's bridging the gap between Return and Force Awakens.
Yeah.
It's called The Journey to the Force Awakens, this book series.
We're gonna see how that turns out.
Oh boy, we're gonna spend a lot of money.
Yeah, no doubt. It's exciting though.
Yeah, it is. It's exciting. Awesome.
Very cool. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you stopping by to just, I don't know, I just wanted to geek out about Star Wars. We haven't talked about it.
That's awesome.
The show.
Anytime, man.
So, yeah, I know. Reiner, we could do this weekly for you, I'm sure.
I could do it daily.
but thanks, guys, and thanks to you for listening, and we will see you next week. Bye.